Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
When ChatGPT launched in late 2022, the possibilities seemed endless for this technology. And it was only getting better and more sophisticated. So much so that folks such as the godfather of AI, the U of T's Geoffrey Hinton, warned of its potential danger. But has AI hit a wall? Are those big exponential gains that were promised beginning to plateau? Are we now in a world of diminishing returns for AI? Let's find out. In Vancouver, British Columbia, here's Gary Marcus. He's Emeritus Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at New York University and the author of the forthcoming book, Taming Silicon Valley. And he joins us now to discuss that. Professor Marcus, great to have you back on TVO. How are you?
It's great to be back.
Excellent. Let's go back a year and a half. ChatGPT becomes a new thing in our lives, or at least for many of us anyway. To what extent do you think that a lot of the excitement and fear around AI since then has been based on the idea that this was only the beginning and that AIs were only going to get exponentially more powerful going forward?
Well, I think everybody is imagining that they'll go exponentially better. There was a earlier system called GPT-2, and then it wasn't that great. GPT-3 was worth looking at, but still not that great. And then GPT-4 was actually genuinely useful for a bunch of people. And it was certainly fun to play with. And I think people were expecting, okay, now we're going to have GPT-5 and GPT-6 and GPT-7, and they're all just going to be so much better. I read somebody saying that every 5 to 14 months, these things double. But they actually misread the study. And the reality is things actually probably have slowed down a little bit. So there was a big leap forward, but we have some problems now. For example, these systems are very greedy in terms of how much data they use. And now they're basically using the whole internet, and sometimes by dodgy means. And that may not be enough to get the performance we really want. So something I haven't said is GPT-4 is really fun to play with, but that doesn't mean that it's commercially useful or that it can do all the things that you might imagine. You know, if you play with it, you find that it often makes mistakes. You don't really know when to trust it. So everybody wants to have better systems. And the hope is, well, we'll just keep making them better and better and bigger and bigger. They're driven by how much data they have, but we're running out of interesting new data. And even worse, we're making up bad data. So people are using things like ChatGPT, to write fake books. And those fake books then are out there. And there's all kinds of garbage on the internet now. Like people have fake paintings that they use with systems like DALL-E. And so the quality of information is going down and it's kind of getting used up. And that's one reason we might see a plateau. Another reason we might see a plateau is even though these systems are fun to play with, they're missing a lot of things that we had in classical AI, like the ability to reason and follow facts. They can't check their own work. They can't do sanity checks or validation. The whole architecture might just never work as well as we hope. We've seen a somewhat similar thing with driverless cars, where people just try to add more and more data, hoping they would work. And so far, they haven't. You know, we've had promises for over 12 years that, oh, we're going to get driverless cars next year. And basically what people have been doing is adding more and more data. But maybe the technology we have right now just isn't good enough. Maybe, you know, some days AI might be fantastic, but this year's AI really might be running into a wall, at least approaching a wall relatively soon.
Well, let me follow up on that, because I saw something on the internet the other day where somebody asks a ChatGPT to put 17 dots on a page. And there's clearly a line of 5 by 5. So there's 25 dots there. And the AI insists, I mean, in a way, it was a bit of an argument. The AI insists, no, I've checked it, and there's only 17 dots there. And it's pretty obvious there's only 25. How does that happen?
So what you have to remember is that what these systems do is they put together little bits of text. And there's a complicated way in which they do it. But I like to call them pastiche machines. They're putting together things that they've seen before. It's as if they could run them through a giant list of synonyms and even paraphrases. But at the end of the day, what they're doing is just predicting the statistics of how people use words. They don't actually have concepts like numbers. They really don't quite understand what numbers are. They don't really understand what a square is. They don't really understand any of the stuff that they're using. One term people have used is stochastic parrots, stochastic meaning random in some sense. Their comprehension is actually much more limited. That example was from my friend Phil Lieben. He sent it to me, and I think I put it on the web. And he had a lot of back and forth with the system, and the system just never really understood what it's talking about. There's a saying in the military, frequently wrong, never in doubt. And that's really, I think, what you have with these systems. They're also right a bunch of times, but they don't know which times they're correct and which times they're not. It's a problem for users because the user doesn't know until they get the output, is it right or wrong? And if you already knew, why are you using this system in the first place? So there's a bit of a problem right now with the quality control on these systems, and they don't have the conceptual depth that a human does.
You've compared some of the hype around AI to the so-called psychics con. What is that?
So that was actually somebody else's idea, but I brought it to public attention yesterday. The idea is that the reason that a mind reader succeeds is partly because the only people who go to the mind reader show in the first place are not the skeptical people, right? Skeptical people are like, why would I watch that? So you start with a set of people that are not skeptical. You throw them a lot of garbage. Some of it sticks. And the people who aren't skeptical are like, wow, they said all these things that are true, forgetting about all the ones that they said were wrong. And that's kind of what happens with the large language models. You have some people that I think are more gullible or that want to believe for whatever reason that this AI is great. And they notice the successes and they don't notice the failures. Well, a scientist says you need a numerator and a denominator here. You need to know what percentage it's correct. You also need to know when it's wrong, how bad are those errors going to be? And so the reality is like everybody got super excited last year. But we are running out of improvements, at least for a little while. Things are slowing down. And if you look at most businesses, they all tried it out last year. Everybody subscribed to the hype, but most people are like, well, we're doing a pilot experiment right now. We're seeing if it works. Maybe we're running 3 pilot experiments. But you see very few people saying, yes, we use this every day and it's absolutely essential for what we do. The only people like that really are programmers. And there's some evidence that it's actually making the quality of their code worse. So you can write faster, but sometimes there are errors and they're hard to debug and so forth. So we're still, I think, a ways from having the practical AI that we're now dreaming of. Like last year was amazing. It brought AI to the public. People realized, hey, this might really help me. But at the same time, I think it was premature. And that right now, the tools that we have are limited in what they can actually do. And we're kind of like fantasizing about some future world. But the tools we don't have, or the tools we have right now are limited. It's kind of like in the age of alchemy, people realized, hey, you can do all this kind of cool stuff with the materials on Earth. But they didn't understand the periodic table. It was too early. I think we're kind of in the age of alchemy. You take these models, you stir them up, you hope that it works, you get a little more data. But, you know, we as a field don't really yet know what we're doing. And right now, the alchemy is reaching its limits, I think, or some limits. We'll move past them someday, but we might need some fundamental ideas like the periodic table to move forward.
Well, to that end, let me circle back to something you said about driverless cars a few moments ago. There are several big companies, Tesla, I guess, being the most prominent of them, that have made a huge bet that driverless cars are going to be with us and normal in not that distant a time. What's your view on that?
I think we're still going to be waiting a while. I've been saying since 2016 that driving is actually a pretty hard problem. Most of it, like 99.5% of the time, maybe even more, is easy. You're just kind of sticking your lane and you signal and everything's great. But sometimes weird things happen. Like there'll be a police officer with a street sign. These systems can't even read the street signs. And so what I warned about in 2016 was edge cases, that you would find weird things that happen. You wouldn't have enough data. You wouldn't have covered it with some rule. And the system would do weird things. I described at the time a case that Stephen Levy had described in Wired about a driverless car and how it was dealing with leaves on the street. And like everybody, Google was so excited they could handle the leaves on the street. And I said, the number of cases like this are going to be endless. It's going to be hard to get them all right. So that was 2016. And nobody listened to me. And I mean, as often they don't. And people poured more and more money into it. You know, $100 billion with a B has gone into driverless cars. There have been promises every year that they're coming next year, that we'll have fleets of them, that you'll be able to loan your car out at night and so forth. But the reality is all we have are demos. It's always easier to build a demo than an actual product. We have demos that kind of work in San Francisco, that kind of work, well, they're about to maybe work in LA, they work in Phoenix. But, you know, if you live in the Northeast, they're not going to work for you. They don't know how to deal with snow. And they don't know how to deal, you know, if they're in Mumbai and they're rickshaws, they're not going to know how to deal with that. They're very narrowly tuned to the particular places they've been trained. Whereas a human driver, you can plop them down somewhere new and more or less they're able to drive. Humans reason about the world. They understand what objects are in the world. Last year, or maybe it was the year before, a Tesla, they have this feature called Summon. You press on your phone to have your car go across a parking lot. Someone did this at an airplane trade show, and the Tesla ran directly into a jet because it hadn't been trained on what jets are. So there's always this new and original case that these systems aren't understanding. Again, I'm not saying we'll never have driverless cars as kind of matter of routine, but every promise about, you know, it's going to be next year makes me cringe. I think we're still a long way from being able to do that reliably and effectively kind of wherever you want to go.
You sound like you're 180 degrees away from where Geoffrey Hinton was and from where he captured so much attention not that long ago when he said that AI could be so intelligent that he feared it might destroy us at some point down the road. Does that suggest that you are really not at all concerned about that, given that you think the whole thing is overblown?
I think there are immediate concerns and there are long-term concerns. The immediate concerns are these things, because they don't understand the world, can easily be exploited by bad actors to make misinformation. And that's already happening, and that's threatening democracy right now, even though these systems aren't very smart. They can also be used to clone voices. You don't have to have a system that really understands the world to clone voices, but a pretend kidnapper can clone your kid's voice and get a ransom out of you. So we already have problems. The issues that Hinton is mostly worried about are, what if machines take over the world? That's not going to happen anytime soon. I don't think anybody can say it will never happen. We don't really know where things will be 50 years from now, 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now. I think it's worth worrying about those things. And in general, I think it's worth worrying about, can we keep the systems that we have safe? Right now, they're very unreliable, and that makes them unsafe. So I'm not 180 degrees away, I guess, because there's different dimensions. I'm less worried about machines taking over the world, but I am very worried about the negative consequences of the ones that we have right now. In fact, every day I kind of ask myself, as someone who's worked in AI, I've built two AI companies, I've worked in the field my whole life. Every day I say, are we doing a good job here? Is AI on balance going to be more positive for humanity, helping with medicine, helping with science, or is it more negative? Right now, there's a lot of negative things. Another one would be non-consensual deep fake porn. There's lots of problems right now. You know, AI is a dual use technology. Another problem is the people making it are using a lot of copyrighted materials without compensating people. So you have to kind of add up the positives and the negatives. Right now, it might be a draw. It's not a clear win. It could even be a loss. I hope we'll build better, more reliable AI, and also that we will regulate the tech companies to make sure that they're not just kind of stealing everybody's data, and that we come up with an AI that's thriving for the whole world. But that's hard work. And that's actually what my next book is about, is I don't think we can trust the companies to get us there. I don't think we can trust the governments to get us there because they're so influenced by the companies. And so I think the public needs to stand up and say, we want an AI that works for us. We realize that this is changing our world fast. We need our political candidates to understand this stuff, to have good policies around it. We, the citizens, need to get involved.
Well, speaking of governments, the government of Canada is certainly placing a big bet that AI is in the future and is going to be a significant part of our future. They just, I think it was $2.4 billion. They made an announcement not too long ago, an investment in many different AI factors. Given where you are on this issue, what does it say about those kinds of bets that governments all over the place are making on this future?
I think that the governments are all right to be placing bets on AI. I think they're placing too much of their bets on the current form of technology, which, as we've talked about, has its limits. And I would like to see more of that money go into research for alternative approaches, because in the end of the day, I think that this one's not going to get us to the promised land, so to speak. And I think that we need to have a broader intellectual community around AI. Right now, everybody's focused in one place. It's sort of like if you invest. People say, don't put it all in stocks. Don't put it all in bonds. Don't put it all in real estate. You want to diversify, right? Right now, the field is not intellectually diversified. There's this one tool, we call it a large language model, built on something called a transformer. And that's almost all of the research. And what I think we need are different approaches, because I do think this one is likely to hit a wall soon. I think we're already seeing a period of diminishing returns where things are slowing down a bit. That's a sign we should be investing in other approaches. It's also a sign to a country like Canada that's not quite leading the game right now, although it has some fabulous people, to maybe try some other things. Maybe Canada could get back in the game if it did something innovative. When you have the entire world focusing on the same exact approach, that's actually time to maybe try something else. And if I had to worry about the Canadian investment, it's that I don't exactly see the means by which it's going to help Canada carve a new path as opposed to kind of following the path that other people are setting right now.
Well, that's very disquieting because, of course, we'd love to know that the $2.4 billion we're budgeting is not just going down a rabbit hole that won't pay off for us at the end of the day. I don't want to read too much into what you're saying, but it sounds like you're saying that money's not necessarily going for anything that's fabulously new or innovative.
I mean, it's going to allowing Canada to play the game that everybody else is playing. So right now, need a lot of money to play the game that everybody else is playing. And I think it's fair that Canada put some money into that. But I would think about places like UBC. I happen to live in Vancouver, that I don't work at UBC, where people are taking different approaches. And, you know, I think they've been left out. I think almost all of the money in Canada has gone to an approach called deep learning. I think we need to look at some other approaches or ways of doing that in other ways and so forth. I hope that some of the money will go not just to building giant clusters of computers that happen to do this one technique well, but also to fostering some other techniques.
Okay, let's finish up on this. And that is, the human mind is an amazing thing that took many billions of years to develop. And here's us, putting billions and lots of effort into creating artificial intelligence, which may or may not be as phenomenal as many people think it is. I guess I'm wondering, at the end of the day, is this more an example of human hubris, thinking we could do in a relatively short space of time what it seems to have taken nature billions of years to figure out?
There's definitely some hubris in the field of AI right now. I think that the people who have the money right now, and they've produced a bunch of good results, but most of them know one thing really well, which is a particular kind of math. And I don't think they look carefully enough at the human mind itself. I think that psychologists, neuroscientists have a lot to contribute here and aren't really being listened to. I think that people who have this one approach that was getting better and better thought it was going to get infinitely better and stopped listening to anybody else. And I think that that's going to hurt them in the end.
I take it you don't think you're going to be paying Elon Musk that $10 million that you bet him anytime soon.
Well, I offered him $1 million. Someone else raised it to 10. The bet was he said that we would have artificial general intelligence smarter than any human being by the end of next year, by the end of 2025. And I said, that's absurd. I offered $1 million. Somebody else raised it to 10. we have not heard from Elon Musk. Wall Street Journal asked for comment, got none. So I don't think he's going to take the bet. I think it's more fun for him to make these amazing predictions and then not have any accountability when they turn out to be wrong. Of course, you know, that's been his playbook for a long time. He's been promising driverless cars every year since 2014 that they would come next year, and they haven't happened yet.
Gotcha.
So I thought I'd make it a little more spicy and put some money on the line.
There is definitely some spice in that bet, no doubt about it. Gary Marcus, we thank you for joining us on the line from Vancouver, BC. It's been a pleasure having you on our program again.
Great to be back. Thanks a lot for talking about this stuff.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.